Full Committee on Veterans Affairs will come to order. Today, June 23, 2005, we will conduct a hearing on examining the budget modeling and methodologies used by the Department of Veterans Affairs to develop and forecast veterans' health cost and utilization projects for future years. This hearing will come to order. We are here this morning to examine the budget modeling and methodologies used by the Department of Veterans Affairs to forecast the cost of veterans' health care and to project usage of the system for future years. The discretionary budget for health care accounts for half of the VA's funding. More than 7 million veterans are enrolled in the VA health system. 5 million of them currently use the system. In 1996, before eligibility reform, there were about half that number in the system. Since 1996, there has been a 1,200% increase in the lower priority enrollees, veterans who have no compensable service-connected disabilities, who are not catastrophically disabled, or who have higher incomes. That is a 12-fold increase in utilization. And we are treating the non-service-connected injuries and illnesses of our service-disabled veterans. In 1996, strike 1996. Yet, as anyone in the health care industry would tell us, forecasting is critically important to providing high-quality care to those who are eligible to receive it. A budget is only as good as the data and assumptions that are used to create it. And we must not only have good data, but we must also have the right data. And we also must have the right assumptions in our forecasting. It's the heart of the budgetary process. The purpose of today's hearing is to learn how we can more accurately forecast the health care demand. That job is complicated by the operational challenges that we must acknowledge. I suggest forecasting challenges of the model include not only the economic assumptions that are used, the effects of eligibility reform, the rise in pharmaceutical costs, the uncertainties of demand in connection with veterans returning from the global war on terror, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in particular, medical inflation, dental costs, accurate and adequate collections, expenditures, etc. We must have a thoughtful and responsive process to ensure that health care will be there for our veterans. We must ask difficult questions today. We must question the assumptions, the data, the input, and assume that we can do better. Our dialogue should help shed light on this very complex process that is critical to the long-term vitality of the health system for America's veterans. We owe our veterans the best of care. VA provides quality health care that in many respects is the envy of the medical community, and we must preserve that quality. I'm proud of the job that are done by the men and women, the employees who care for our veterans in the VA. In fact, the VA's new Undersecretary for Health, Dr. John Perlin, in his previous position was the first Deputy Undersecretary to regularly see patients at the Washington VA Medical Center. His new job has changed that a bit, but I understand that he has volunteered for the midnight shift, and I respect you for that. He exemplifies the very best and what is good about our system. It is the responsibility of Congress and this committee to ensure that Dr. Perlin has the resources necessary to do his job. Sound health care forecasting is essential to doing precisely that. And I look forward to this hearing and the engagement of my colleagues. The only experience I'll share with my colleagues that I had with this prior to the TRICARE for Life, when we were under the CHAMPUS and we had the military retirees going through the base closure and we were trying to figure out our health care budgets, and we had this huge ebb and flow of a ghost population in and out of a health system, our modeling had tremendous errors. And we had a very extensive hearing on how to improve that. Once we went to TRICARE for Life, we brought in also predictability into a system. But when you get into the actual, I don't know if I can call it a science, but I suppose you can. You get into the science of this health modeling, we can begin to be more accurate. What's often being used in this town is everybody throws and uses numbers out there with regard to our budgets. Let's try to figure this out. And I've not seen that in the 13 years I've been on this committee, and so we're going to do this today. This will be hard. It'll be a heavy lift. And I think it, by reading the statements last night, all of you have put a tremendous effort in this, and I appreciate your efforts. I now yield to Mr. Evans for an opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Budgets are not just numbers. They order our national priorities and establish policy. Sometimes it's easy to forget the human component when we talk about these numbers. Sometimes it's hard to remember that often the numbers we use are poor substitutes for the reality we are trying to measure. I look forward to the witnesses that appear before us today. It is vitally important to accurately identify the real resource requirements of the VA healthcare system. It is vital that we then provide these resources free from arbitrary fiscal considerations. Sadly, it does not matter how accurate budget forecasts are if those forecasts are not fully funded. I agree with the voices of veterans who across the country have called on our attention the disparity between what the VA needs and what it often gets. There was a concern of the Presidential Task Force, which drew attention to, quote, current mismanagement between demand for VA services and funding. My assured funding bill, which would do just that by requiring the federal government to provide adequate funding based on the number of veterans enrollees. I'm looking forward to the hearings on H.R. 515. I look forward to the day when we can develop and provide VA the benefits based on their need and their support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Any other colleagues have an opening statement? Mr. Filner.
Just a question, if I may, for the chairman. Clearly, the balance of powers in the Constitution gives us oversight authority over the executive branch, and this hearing is very important for the VA to come to us and let us know how they're doing. And I would associate myself with all the remarks you made about the budget process. I frankly don't understand the second panel. That is, we do not have oversight over independent groups. The motivation for this is suspicious to me. That is, the independent budget or any group, the American Legion can say anything they want, and we could ask them when they testify how they came up with that situation. But for us to put them in the equivalent position of the VA and demand that they be here and explain how they did something seems to me a hidden agenda here, or it's not so hidden. It's a pretty open agenda, and I just want to object to the put on the record, object to the structure of this hearing. It's very appropriate for us to question the VA the way we're going to do this and understand it. It is not in terms of the independent budget.
Mr. Chairman, over here.
Yes, Mr. Miller.
If I could ask Mr. Filner a question.
You are recognized for an opening statement.
My opening statement is, without fail, year after year, the annual budget for VA Health Administration is subject to great debate, and we all know that more and more veterans are relying on VA for their health care needs, and it's important that we do understand the department's methodology for forecasting health care costs and utilization projections. I do look forward to hearing from all of today's witnesses, and I do have a question for Mr. Filner.
I'm perfectly willing to.
I must be blind, but I don't understand. What do you think the agenda is with the second group of folks? I'm sorry.
The chairman has. If the gentleman will yield, the chairman has taken issue with the legitimacy of the independent budget in open hearings, where some of us have used the Bible at it, and he wants to undermine the credibility of the independent budget, in my view.
You may be a little mistaken when the hearing is over, but we all question the validity of the independent budget, so I put myself and associate myself with the chairman in this particular case.
Mr. Gentleman, yield back. Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank all of the witnesses here today for enlightening us as to how they determine future costs. I appreciate your explanations, and they are very enlightening. But all of this discussion does not get to the root of the question. Every year, the VA does its budget modeling. OMB have its views as to what the numbers should be, and the independent budget come out with its own numbers. It seems almost as if everyone agrees that the VA need more funding to complete its mission, the mission being to provide the best health care to our national veterans. Everyone is discussing numbers. How can we cut costs, save a little bit here, cut some fat there. We are talking about people, and many of them come to my office, by the way, and we are budgeting for better health care for our veterans, or are we budgeting for saving money? The independent budget come out with its estimates every year. A coalition of veteran groups get together and figure out what veterans need. The president comes out with his budget every year. This budget affects every aspect of our lives, and he decides to pay for the war in Iraq on the backs of our veterans. The independent budget says that we need an additional $3 billion, and I don't disagree with them. How can these two numbers be so different? Everyone begins with the same starting point. There is a known number of veterans, and a procedure costs X amount of dollars. What happens to the VA's numbers after they are modeled when OMB get a host of them and cut it by almost 90%? I mean, the budget that VA starts out with, and then when it goes to OMB, it's totally different. What is the rationale for cutting veterans' benefits? Whether the veterans have a service-connected rating or 100% or is priority aid and not homeless, each serve his or her country honorably and deserve care from the VA. I am hoping that this committee can get back to its purpose of serving the veterans. We are independent from the administration, and we should act that way. I yield back the balance of my time.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you and the ranking member for holding today's hearings and highlighting an issue that I think is critical for all veterans, health care cost modeling and appropriate funding for health care of VA. First, Mr. Chairman, let me begin by welcoming and congratulating Dr. Perrin on his recent nomination and confirmation to the position of Undersecretary of Health at VA. I believe that his assumption of that post marks an important milestone as this committee continues to work with the VA to improve the quality of care provided to our nation's veterans. So again, welcome and congratulations to you, Dr. Perlin. In addition, Dr. Perlin, I believe we have two panels of folks here today that can help us better understand the efforts that VA goes through in determining how much funding is annually required to maintain the excellent care VA is providing nationwide. It is my hope that my colleagues will come away today with a better sense of two important issues. Number one, the inherent challenge that faces those who try to accurately forecast the demands for care inside the VA. And number two, the level of strain it puts on the department and our veterans when those projections fail to meet the mark. To that end, I am interested in hearing today how the VA's modeling process compares to that of Department of Defense, the independent budget, the American Legion's demand model, and finally, the efforts put towards the private sector to gauge health care costs and demands for medical services. More importantly, however, I want to explore how the VA can become more efficient in accurately gauging the demands for health services and how we as members of Congress can be assured that our veterans will continue to receive the level of care they have come to rely on. Mr. Chairman, again, I thank you and Ranking Member Evans for holding this hearing today. I look forward to the testimony of our panels, and I hope that we explore the modeling process today. We continue to remember that the numbers are important, but our main concern should always be that our veterans are treated with respect and afforded the level of care that VA has become so efficient in providing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Berkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also think this is a very important hearing today, and I'm very delighted that we are discussing the VA budget process and the modeling used to determine the future needs of our vets. As you have heard me say on many occasions, Southern Nevada has one of the fastest growing veterans populations in the country. Over 50,000 of my veterans depend on the VA for their health care needs. Every year, it is very difficult going back home after our hearings and explaining to my veterans that their service organizations' projections and the amount of money that we know it would require to take care of our veterans adequately is not what we're voting on. They don't understand the disparity, and they don't understand the difference. Not only, in my opinion, should the VA use the most accurate tools to determine what veterans' needs will be in the future, but we, Congress, must provide the resources that are necessary to provide health care services to our veterans. And I can never get out of my mind when we had hearings with then VA Secretary Principi, and somebody asked the secretary, after he made his presentation on how much money he was requesting of Congress to satisfy the health care needs of the veterans, the question was asked, is this the amount that you presented to the president? His response was no, and apparently his presentation to the president had requested at least, if I'm not mistaken, $1.2 billion more than he actually presented to Congress.
Ms. Berkley, would you yield on that point?
Yes, I will yield.
Here. I'm over here.
Oh, yes, I will yield.
Thank you. You bring up the key question that is going to be neglected on the first panel, and I would ask the chairman if he invited OMB to being here, because it doesn't matter what they model. If OMB says no, OMB has the word on what the budget's going to be. Not any of these models could be way off. It doesn't even matter. OMB makes that decision, and we ought to be checking that is what we ought to be doing.
Thank you, Mr. Filner, and if I could reclaim my time, although I agree very much with what you're saying. I'm also very concerned with our returning soldiers. The VA has treated more than 85,000 of the 360,000 veterans from Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom deployment as of May 2005. Mr. Chairman, I have another protocol hearing for IR that I have to be at by 11 o'clock, but I have a question that I'd like to submit, and I'm very sorry I'm not going to be here to
Berkley,
listen to this.
You have it?
Yes.
Now? Why don't you ask it?
All right. For the future,
they'll write it down and then they'll.
Great. All right. If you can incorporate this into your comments, I'd like to know how the VA is ensuring that returning soldiers are being put in these models and ensuring that they accurately project and provide the needed resources for these new veterans in the VA healthcare system. Southern Nevada is going to be overwhelmed by people coming home from Iraq, and not necessarily our current residents, but that's the place that people. Returning veterans are going to be moving, and we're going to need to ensure that we have the adequate resources for the needs of these veterans. And I suspect that they're going to be extraordinary needs, not only physical but mental as well. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesy.
Thank you. Any other opening statements? Mr. Michaud.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you and Ranking Member Evans for having this hearing. Looking forward to hearing the panel, and I believe that budgets are a reflection of our priorities, Mr. Chairman. So in the essence of time, I would ask that my opening statements be submitted for the record.
Without objection. Thank you. Any other members have opening statements to be submitted for the record? Hearing none, I will what I'd like to do is for my colleagues, I don't normally do this, but I'm going to introduce each one of these individuals that are in front of us on the first panel, and I'll also introduce right now the second panel, and explain an opportunity that we have to be very constructive in the process here. And the reason I need to do this is the second panel, also being the independent budget and the American Legion that operates outside the independent budget, is, as we all know, under the rules, the minority have rights. And we, in cooperation, decide who the witnesses are going to be. And the second panel is the request of the Democrats. So let me, Dr. Jonathan Perlin serves as the Chief Executive Officer of the Veterans Health Administration, the country's largest integrated health system. Dr. Perlin recently was sworn in as the current Undersecretary for Health in the Department of Veterans Affairs, having served as acting in that role since April 2004. He has a background in healthcare quality management, health information technologies, medical education, and health service research. To his right is Ms. Rita Reed. She manages and directs all VA budget activities as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Budget. She is responsible for managing over $68.5 billion under the fiscal year 2005 enacted budget. Ms. Reed has worked on the budget issues since she started the VA in 1978. We also have directly in front of me is Mr. Jimmy Norris. He serves as the principal financial advisor to the Undersecretary for Health in his role as the chief financial officer of the Veterans Health Administration. He oversees the budget formulation, justification, and execution process of the VHA, as well as the financial management systems. Over here on our far left is Mr. Arthur Klein. He oversees the actuaries of the healthcare demand model and its integration into the development of the healthcare policy impacting VHA as the Director of Policy Analysis and Forecasting Office in VHA's Office of the Assistant Deputy Undersecretary for Health Policy and Planning. We also have then to the right of Mr. Norris is Mr. John Kukulis. Okay, to our right of Mr. Norris. So he serves as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Budgets and Financial Policy as the Chief Financial Officer for the TRICARE Management Activity. To his left, or to the right from us, He is also the Principal Staff Assistant and Advisor to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs for all financial policies, programs, and activities for the military health system in the Department of Defense. He also provides the medical financial interface between DOD and VA. To his right, to his left, our, as I appear to the right, is Ms. Kathy Patterson. She serves as the Principal and Consulting Actuary for Milliman, Incorporated, with a background of 19 years in health actuarial experience. She leads this company's practice in research and analysis of veteran data as an expert in actuarial modeling for the veterans population. That is our first panel. So let me now yield to Mr. Perlin.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Evans, and members of the committee. First, let me start by thanking you for your support of veterans and VA and for the opportunity to be here this morning to discuss the Department of Veterans Affairs actuarial healthcare demand model. Mr. Chairman, I'll present a summary of my testimony and, with your approval, submit my full statement for the record.
No objection. So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, the Veterans Health Care Eligibility Reform Act of 1996 established a uniform package of health care services for enrollees. The legislation also established a priority-based enrollment system and required the VA Secretary to annually assess veteran demand for VA health care, determine whether resources are available to provide timely, quality care to all enrollees. In the past, VHA budgets were based on historical expenditures that were adjusted for inflation and then increased based on proposed new initiatives. With the implementation of eligibility reform and a shift to ambulatory care, VHA needed to more rationally budget for veteran requirements in the transformed healthcare system. We also needed to be able to continually adjust budgetary projections for the effects of shifting trends in the veteran population and healthcare delivery. As a result, VA engaged the firm of Milliman Incorporated to produce actuarial projections of veteran enrollment, healthcare service utilization, and expenditures. Milliman consults to health insurers and is the largest and most respected actuarial firm in providing actuarial healthcare modeling. The VHA enrollee healthcare demand model develops estimates of future veteran enrollment and the enrollee's expected utilization for 55 discrete healthcare services and the costs associated with that utilization. These projections are consolidated and are available by fiscal year, enrollment priority, age, VISN, market, and facility, and are provided for a 20-year period. The actuarial data are then used to support budget planning and future resource requirements. Because of the federal budgeting process, data are used for budget planning approximately 2 to 3 years forward. Of course, the near-term projections, such as for the one-year window, are more reliable than further out. The model provides risk adjustment and reflects enrollees' morbidity, mortality, and their changing healthcare needs as veterans age. Because some enrollees have other healthcare options, The model reflects how much care enrollees receive from the VA, our own health care system, versus that of other health care providers. And this concept is known as VA reliance. Each year, the model is updated with the latest data on enrollment, health care service utilization, and service costs. Methodology and assumptions used in the model are also reviewed to ensure that the model is projecting veteran demand as accurately as possible. VA and Milliman develop annual plans to improve data inputs on the model and the modeling methodology. On average, for the past 3 years, patient projections have been within 0.6% of actual patients, and enrollee projections have been within plus 1.9% of actual enrollees. There may be slightly more variance this year, and in a system as large as VA, a modest percentage change equates to a very large number of veterans. Some services that VA provides are not modeled by Milliman. These include readjustment counseling, dental services, the Foreign Medical Program, CHAMP VA, spina bifida, and non-veteran medical care. Demand estimates and budgets for these programs are developed by their respective program managers. Enrollee demand for long-term care services is modeled by VHA. The VHA long-term care model uses utilization rates from nationally recognized surveys adjusted to the unique characteristics of the enrollee population and the known reliance factors to account for such attributes as distance, multiple eligibilities, case management, and then to project demand for both nursing home care and community-based care. In conclusion, the development of the actuarial model has been an evolutionary process. Future planned improvements include access to data on enrollees' use of Medicaid, TRICARE, and the military treatment facilities, as well as the integration of VHA long-term care modeling into the actuarial model and modeling of additional services such as dental care. Mr. Chairman, the VHA enrollee health care demand model is a valuable budgeting and planning tool for projecting VA health care utilization to ensure that VA can provide safe, effective, timely, efficient, and compassionate health care to veterans. We combine VA's substantial experience with a contractor with unpeered expertise in health care modeling to achieve the best actuarial projections possible. This completes our statement. We'd be pleased to answer your questions.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of this committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss modeling and budgeting for health care costs in the military health system. We have three distinct missions in the MHS. First, to deploy a healthy military force. Second, to deploy a ready medical force. And third, to manage our beneficiary care through the administration of our TRICARE benefit. In my statement here today, I will focus on our forecasting and modeling of the TRICARE benefit, since it makes up the largest portion of our MHS budget. The Department of Defense offers the TRICARE benefit to approximately 9 million eligible beneficiaries. 19% of this population is made up of uniformed services personnel. Their families and members make up another 27%, and retirees and their family members and survivors account for the remaining 54%. TRICARE offers our beneficiaries a variety of options for attaining this health care coverage. Beneficiaries can obtain health care coverage at our military treatment facilities, a civilian provider who is part of our private sector network, or from a certified civilian provider of their choice. Our beneficiaries can also obtain their prescriptions through our MTFs, through retail outlets, or through our TRICARE mail order pharmacy. The challenges we face as we prepare our annual budget, including predicting how many of our eligible beneficiaries will use the TRICARE benefit, what options they will select, how often they will require care and prescriptions, what inflation rates will impact our procurement of services, and the impact of recently enacted changes in benefits. In developing projected trends for these underlying care costs, our analysis includes consideration of the following: an actuarial forecast of our population for the coming year. Second, recent trends in our contractors' health care costs due to the attraction of new users, volume trends, and inflation. Third, recent and projected trends in private sector health plans and the national health care sector in general. And four, effects and changes in the TRICARE program itself, such as benefit changes, changes in provider reimbursement policies, and contract transitions. Using our claims database, we then decompose the historical trends in these underlying health care costs to determine what factors would be ongoing versus one-time events. These factors include the global war on terrorism, changes in the number of TRICARE eligibles under the age of 65, changes in the percentage of that group who actually use TRICARE, and 4, changes in the cost per user, including changes in unit cost and the volume of services per user. In addition, we assess the forecasted growth in pharmacy, both for increase in users and increase in unit price. These methodologies enable us to construct a forecast for our expenditures for the coming year. Given the growth and volatilities of these expenditures, our department is engaged in a continuous effort to reduce our costs and improve the predictability of our obligations. These activities have included, 1, a consolidation and realignment of the TRICARE healthcare regions from 12 regions down to 3, allowing us a more streamlined administration of these plans and enhanced portability for our beneficiaries. 2, a movement to performance-based budgeting for our MTFs with a phased implementation of a new prospective payment budgeting approach. We intend to base MTF budgets on workload output such as hospital admissions and clinic visits rather than relying on historical resource levels such as number of staff employed, supply costs, and other materials. Once fully implemented, PPS should allow us for better management performance at the MHS. And 3, the redesign of our pharmacy program into a single integrated program, allowing us to more effectively manage this effort. We are also standardizing formulary management and are promoting the use of more cost-effective products and points of service. In addition to these and other activities, we are also actively working with the Department of Veterans Affairs, where we can share resources to increase access, improve quality, and more efficiently deliver the health care benefit to our beneficiaries. We currently have 12 projects being funded this year from our joint DOD-VA incentive fund. In summary, the military health system has many factors that drive its annual expenditures. The department has made progress in our efforts to better forecast and control these expenditures, and will continue these efforts into the future. There is more work to be done. Through it all, we have and will continue to focus on job one, which is to appropriately fund our medical readiness requirement and to provide exceptional care to our active duty personnel, their families, and our retirees who have sacrificed so much for our country. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for inviting me here today, and at your convenience, I'll be happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you very much. I don't know the answer to this, so I just have to ask. With regard to your budgets, when we did one of the supplementals, did you participate? Did DOD Health participate in one of the supplementals that we sent over to DOD?
For the VA?
For 05.
For 05 supplemental for...
For an 05 supplemental to DOD, did
yes.
you get monies out
yes,
of that supplemental?
Did. Yes, we did.
Do you remember what amount?
I want to say it was approximately $680
million. $680
million?
Yes. Okay.
For the GWAT supplemental.
Now, you are transitioning to a performance-based budgetary methodology.
Yes.
And your prior methodology was more demand?
It was more based on what is your historical cost.
Well, and the trends.
Exactly.
Simplified here.
And now we're actually saying, okay, what workload are you doing in terms of number of visits, hospital visits, number of clinic visits, and then taking a reimbursement rate based on the private sector and then reimbursing the MTFs for those visits versus right. paying them on a historical basis.
So with the VA and their model, do you have any knowledge about their modeling or just based on what you've known?
No, since I joined the DOD in April, so I'm busy ramping up on my own.
Have you read Dr. Perlin's testimony?
I have not.
Okay.
I have not.
When you do your your model,
yes.
is it a 1 year?
No, we actually go out many years. It's like Dr. Perlin says, a 3 year look.
Yours is a 3 year.
Obligation.
This is a 2.5.
Yep. But basically, when you get into the key to our whole modeling is that actuarial forecast of your population, and that's really where you get the granularity so that you can have some numbers that you can have some confidence in, and that's really a 12-month look.
Ms. Patterson, in the private sector, it is what? When you do your models?
Private sector, you do your 3 year plan. You can
Ms.
do your.
Patterson.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. It's more difficult to budget out for 1 year rather than 3 or 5 or 10.
Your company does budgeting contracting for a lot of the private health systems in the country, does
that's
it
correct.
Not?
That's correct.
So in the private sector, when it comes to for profit, they're doing it in 1 month, or excuse me, for 1 year. So DOD's doing a 3 year model and VA's doing a 2.5 year model. Is that?
It's 2.5 to 3.5 window.
2.5 to 3.5 window. All right. With regard to DOD's budget, you participated in this supplemental in 05.
Yes.
Did you participate in the supplemental in 04 and in 03?
I'll have to take that for the record and get back to you on it. I'm not sure.
All right. Do you, I know that the operations, OIF, OEF,
yes,
are having some strains on your system, are
they
not?
They are, definitely.
And so 680 was your bogey that we had,
yes,
to plus up. Any other, with regard to your modeling, in your trends and forecasts or methodologies, as you move to this new model, were there errors or corrections or things that you needed to do better forecasting? Because we already gave, you know, we just passed you an 06 budget.
Yes.
So you're a little more in comfort?
There's always things that pop up, such as emerging requirements, whether it be all of a sudden we need a Tamiflu vaccine for the aviary flu virus, and that's an emerging requirement that has to be funded, and we have to find offsets. But as far as the implement of PPS, we are in its infancy, and as we roll it out and do lessons learned on ourselves, what we're finding in the initial round, we did a poor job on incorporating readiness. We have a dual mission. You have the regular healthcare mission,
yes,
and then you have readiness. So you get into this, what is the cost of readiness, and how do you reimburse the MTFs for things they're doing to prepare the troops as they get prepared for battle? So
okay,
we need to do a better job there.
So, Dr. Perlin, now that we recognize that the military health delivery system was short about $680 million, covered in a supplemental appropriations, in practical terms, if OIF and OEF contribute to actuarial and budgetary challenges for FY05-06 within DOD, it's got to be there for you too. Can you please comment on OIF-OEF's challenges with regard to what it's doing to your budget forecasting?
Sure. First, we're proud, privileged to take care of our newest combat veterans. In the last 2 years, we're aware, as we've testified in the recent hearing on seamless transition, that as of end April, we're aware of 360,674 who separated from service in that period. Of that, as of end April, about 85,857 had presented for care in VA. Most of them, the issues of younger generation, and another 17,274, so together in excess of 100,000, that 17,000 had presented to our Veterans Readjustment Counseling Center. 2.5 to 3.5 years ago, when this budget was formulated, there would have been no way to predict that these combat veterans would have come to VA.
All right, let's break it out. Of part of the medical services that you're providing for them, part of this surge in utilization is coming from what?
Sir, it ranges the spectrum. Fortunately, the majority of young men and women coming to us come with the issues and illness of that age. We are prepared for and taking care of additional mental health care needs, and there are a number who are grievously injured, and we provide very intensive care and rehabilitation to those.
And is it not true there's a trend with the DOD right now saying with regard to guardsmen and reservists? See, Congress has said, I tell you what, we'll open up the VA, we'll take care of these guardsmen and reservists, you can gain access to the VA. We recognize that was not in your budgeting forecast, okay? But with regard to dental, what's happening?
Well, we're working together with DOD. This is a very close collaboration, but there's a difference between dental health, which VA is helping to restore, and operational readiness. And in the area of dental, we have collectively identified a number of about $90 million of unanticipated dental health care needs in this cohort alone.
All right. If you've identified a $90 million that you didn't anticipate with regard to dental, and you've got this surge in medical utilization from these other soldiers that are now accessing your system, have you been able to put a number on that?
We are working on identifying a number, but obviously we are using additional resources that we didn't anticipate at the time that we budgeted 2.5 years ago.
I know my colleagues, I know I've exceeded my time. If I could go for two more questions, because I think we're getting close here. With regard to your forecasting, you're 2.5 years out. You've got some challenges today that were not anticipated. The VA, you usually do a mid-year review, do you not?
Yes,
with regard to your budgets to make sure how you're going to do, right?
Yes, sir.
Congress, we authorize DOD for you to be able to have a carryover, right, and VA, so you carry over. What do you carry over?
2%.
2%, which is actually 400 plus million?
$298 million
this year. Normally you'll carry over?
Like for next year, it would be approximately $350 million, so
right,
close to $400 million.
$350. All right. What is your normal carryover, Dr. Perlin?
Well, for 2006, we had anticipated bringing forward $482 million. At this point, we have assessed, and we think it'll be closer to 75, perhaps as low as 50 in that particular account.
Because of some
unanticipated increased utilization has committed us, unanticipated by the actual model, increased health care associated in part with new combat veterans coming to us for service, as well as unanticipated increase because of projections that where we weren't on the mark from the actuarial model have required us to use resources that at the point of budgeting had been intended to carry forward. And to be fair, we are bringing all resources to make sure that we can provide timely and effective care to veterans. That's going beyond our budget projections for 05 as well.
Can I keep going for a second? Like, how far off do you believe you may be from, you know, the contracted model that you have to where we are potentially right now?
Right. Well, while this is the most rational and effective way to predict, I think we have to realize that we're pushing the performance envelope on this model. As Ms. Patterson said, it is at its best when one projects in the immediate year ahead. Because the federal budgeting process, we're projecting 2.5 to 3.5 years ahead. And in fact, the plan was for 2.3% growth, and the actual growth is 5.2%. And that's a 2.9% increase annualized. We've had some months this year where we're ahead even further and 3.4% ahead. Now, I know 3.4% sounds pretty darn good on an actuarial model, and it is, but that small number translates into a very large number of veterans.
And, all right, large number of veterans. Large with regard to a projected dollar, you know, if you're projecting this out between now and the beginning of the next fiscal year, you're going to have to be moving some monies around in order to maintain the quality of care and the access of care to those veterans. So you're going to have to be moving some funds, are you not?
That is correct.
And do you know about how much or from what sources you're going to be able to do that?
Right. In addition to using resources which had been intended to be carryover, we have used some of the funds associated with capital, non-recurring maintenance. Now, I do need to tell you that after 4 years of very robust support by the administration, we have invested in the infrastructure, but this year we're using some of those capital dollars to make sure that we provide timely care to the veterans who are coming to us.
Right now, based on your testimony, if we take about 80 on dental and you talk about the carryover of around 350, I mean, we're approaching half a billion. Are there some other challenges out there that we don't know about with regard to getting to the fiscal year end, maybe surge from sevens and eights or anything else?
There appears to be increased utilization among you referred to the concept of ghost users. And when we have the patients use the system and the enrollees, there appears to be variance from the model as well in terms of the relationship of patients to enrollees, with greater utilization there as well.
All right. And are you able to give a projection dollar figure that you're going to have to move from potential capital accounts, as you've indicated?
We are still working on a final number, but it could be as high as $600 million.
Well, I can do pretty easy math. That's $1 billion.
Yes, sir.
So, can I go one more? Can I keep going for a second?
Who's going to say no?
Congratulations on your new job. You have a tremendous challenge in front of you. You have, I'm almost stumbling. We have a challenge also. We have a model that has, we do everything we can to address forecasting, assumptions, actuarial, morbidity, utilization, name it. On top of that, we are engaged in a global war on terror, and we're taking care of soldiers who are coming back, plus we have an increase in utilization of our veterans of the past. So we've got, which causes a variance in your present budget in a model that has pressed the boundary of its forecast. Am I close, Ms. Patterson?
Sorry, you would press the boundaries of any forecasting model to go out 3 years.
Wow, this is already constructive. All right, I'll go last one, and I'm going to yield. Unless you've got something off of what I just said, Jess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to get this question in before I have to leave momentarily, because I think it goes along the line of questioning you're pursuing and a comment you made at the beginning, and that is, how you're integrating base realignment and closure rounds into the model. Because I just came back from Ellsworth Air Force Base, which is on the list currently, and if we have people that work in that area that may lose their employer-sponsored coverage because of businesses that are affected, then they're seeking access to the VA system, as we've seen in other parts of the country, whether it's a BRAC round or it's a closure of a mill or what have you. Has that been incorporated? I think the chairman mentioned in the past there's been a concern about whether or not BRAC's been incorporated in the model. And if you're looking 2.5 to 3.5 years out, I mean, is this another anticipated cost we could be seeing, maybe not this year's end since the closures won't happen for about another 2 years?
Yeah. I ask Art Klein to elaborate on how the model incorporates such actions as potential realignments under base realignment commission.
We know it's going to take time, especially when some of these construction actions are going to take place. And what we are doing is planning to include that into our actuary model in the future. So in the 07 budget and 08 budgets, we will be able to identify that better in our actuary model.
All right. Right before I'm going to yield to Mr. Evans, it appears we have some tremendous challenges in front of us. The committee with regard to oversight, we're going to continue to get into how you do your methodology and your forecasting. At the same time, we now realize you have a tremendous challenge in meeting the present need and requirements, and that you have money and you're going about to move them around accounts, and we're going to need to learn and understand more about how you're going to be moving monies to meet particular needs and what effect that's going to have if you have this shortfall of approximately $1 billion. I yield to Mr. Evans in 05.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to yield my time to the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Michaud.
No objection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Evans. I got a couple set of questions. In the early process of the VA must estimate the funding gap that will be faced with what it attempts to do, to close that gap. At what point in time does the ideal model become affected by non-health care considerations? My second part of that question is, when are we essentially modeling to fit predetermined outcomes and not modeling based on health care and the patient requirements? Those are my first two questions. The next two relates to an article on Tuesday in the Washington Post, which had which was entitled "Health Care Costs Spending Up: More in Middle Class Could Join Ranks of Uninsured." The article points out that spending for those with private insurance rose 8.2% in 2004. The medical cost growth has outstrip the growth in wages, and that 45 million Americans, nearly 15% of our population, are uninsured. And many veterans who previously relied on their health care insurance are now turning to the VA. And similar to Congresswoman Hurthfest and the chair, how are the effects of growing numbers of uninsured accounted for in the models? And it's not only the BRAC process, which will definitely affect, but the number of job losses, how has that affected the outside factors in the model?
Well, thank you, Mr. Mishu, for that question. Let me divide it into a couple parts. To your first and second comments, the model runs independently. It factors in the trends in health utilization and secular environmental trends in terms of the health services delivery and use of health insurance or anything else that may be going on in the environment. In terms of how these things are factored in, I would defer to the actuary, who really is the most knowledgeable about the describing that aspect in the operation of the model.
The model has two components that can address that. One is we project enrollment into the VA healthcare system, and once those veterans have enrolled, then we project their healthcare needs. Dr. Perlin addressed the trend rates that we employ in the model to address some of the healthcare changes over time, anticipated healthcare changes over time. With respect to enrollment, if in fact there is an increase in the unemployment rate in particular areas and whatnot, that would need to be handled within the enrollment projections. And we've based enrollment projections on historical trends. We have what we call priority transition within the model, which takes into account, one tiny example of this transition is priority 7 and priority 8 veterans transitioning into priority 5 veterans. So those would be the poorer of the non-service connected disabled veterans. And so it takes it into account in many different aspects. It also has the functionality to actually measure the impact of a potential major downturn in the economy and such. We have not modeled that to date, but it does have the capability of doing that the way it's set up.
If I might follow up, Mr. Chairman, I mean, that's a good point. You're using averages in models. What really concerns me is we've heard a lot over, particularly the last year and election year, how well the economy is going around the country, but that might not be necessarily factual in certain regions, and that's my big concern, because we've had labor market areas in Maine whose unemployment rate was as high as 35%. In certain labor market areas, particularly when you look at Maine, 16% of our population are veterans. We have a high number who are in the Guards and Reserves that's been over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, that's why I'm kind of questioning, the overall model and what assumptions can, how accurate is that model when you look at, the unemployment rate, particularly in separate regions of the country.
Right, and I can address that in that, yes, it does use historical data to develop some of the future assumptions, but our enrollment assumptions are they're not at the county level. We have something we call sectors, which are, for the most part, large counties become a sector, but some of the rural counties that are quite small are grouped into sectors. But we do calculate enrollment rates at that detailed level and by three different age bands, so that hopefully if there has been a chronic unemployment issue in a particular area, that will be reflected in the enrollment rates. If there's something that's happening or expected to happen in the future, if we are made aware of that, we can certainly model that in the current modeling program.
In Dr. Perlin, the second part of that question is at what point in time do you throw out the model and your budget request is primarily driven by monetary aspects?
The model comes forward intact, and obviously in any given year there will be development of new policy initiatives. I believe they're pretty transparent. We had some vigorous debate and discussion of some of the policy initiatives that came forward this year. So the model comes forward intact.
So in other words, the budget requested, that the VA requested to the administration reflects what the model actually intacts, and it's not inaccurate. So in other words, does the VA disagree with the independent budget as far as the assumptions put together in the independent budget?
I think in general, the model comes forward, and then there are policy initiatives, as I mentioned, and then perhaps other assumptions such as efficiencies that constitute the entirety of the overall budget that's presented.
If I might, one other question, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned, Dr. Perlin, about moving, using capital funds, which might be good for the short term. It's a two-part question. I guess my concern is, even though you're using capital funds to meet your current needs now, which is strained, what long-term effect will that have on the budget, whether it's cost-effective? The other concern is, and I can tell you, using Togus Hospital in Maine, the Togus facilities actually had to put up scaffolding over the doors to block bricks from falling on patients or staff, which is a big concern of mine, you know, shifting money around like that. Have you done analysis on the long term? Actually increase the budget of the VA by taking away those capital dollars?
Well, thanks for that question. Obviously, we appreciate the robust support that the VA budget has had over the last 4 years, and that's allowed us to invest in a number of capital equipment areas. And we recognize that this is a short-term strategy. The short-term strategy ensures that between that and using the carryover, we have enough resources to care for veterans this year. That said, it's not viable in perpetuity not to invest in the infrastructure. Sooner or later, you have to make that investment. And the things that are curtailed first are those things that are at the first cut cosmetic, at deeper cuts modernization, remodeling, not those things that allow us to purchase the capital equipment.
Thank you. Before I yield to Mr. Villarakis, I have to correct a statement I made prior to my yielding to Mr. Evans when I referred to this $1 billion challenge for 05, or I called it a shortfall. Really, I'm trying to figure out what you really have for 06, not 05. So, because you have monies right now that you're utilizing for a workaround, moving dollars from your capital accounts, and you're using a cushion account. But we just passed a budget with regard to 06, an appropriation that gave you an additional $1 billion over and above what the President had requested. So now we're going to have to try to get in here and figure out how we need to help you with regard to your 06. And that's going to be our continued challenge. I yield down to Mr. Villarakis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Patterson, you've been assigned, I guess, I don't know whether that's the right word, by Milliman to the VA since 1996, something like that?
I didn't work directly for VA back in 1996, but yes, I was involved in the first discussions of a new model.
And you also do private work? When I say private work, I mean other than the VA, private firms?
Yes, but my major other clients are Medicaid, either states or health plans.
So they're all government. So when you do your actuary work, when you do your actuary work for, you've done actuary work though for private clients.
Yes, I have.
Okay, what was the age of the data that you used for those private clients?
For private sector, depending on whether we're using our health cost guidelines from our firm or whether we're using some of the client's actual data, it's usually as most current as it can be. We have something called lag or run out where you want to make sure that your claims data is complete and that the providers have had time to actually get it submitted and paid and into the system. But usually the most recent year of data is incorporated into any modeling effort.
most recent year then being one
right,
year?
Right, with like a 6 month to a 9 month lag.
Yeah, all right. Mm-hmm. So what's your opinion about the fact that VA uses two plus year old data?
Well, I guess in consideration of the fact that you need to budget out that far, you don't really have a choice.
Well, you're budgeting out that far ahead.
Correct.
But I'm talking about using old data.
Oh, we're using fiscal. The most recent projections use fiscal year 04.
Yeah, well, that's for what? For 07?
Yes.
For
that's 07. The most complete data at the time we do the modeling. And that's very consistent with what's done in the private sector. It's just that they would be budgeting for
why,
a more current
why,
period.
All right. The this $1 billion that has been talked about, this shortfall, call it what we will, which is being made up for on an internal basis, as the good doctor explained. That's the result of what, in your opinion? It's not bad actuarial figures on your part, right?
I guess I don't know that that's an appropriate question for me, but I will go with it. My opinion is that the model forecasts, as well as the data that goes into it, I think some of the things that have occurred over the past year or so were not reflected in the model because they've occurred in the last year or so and they weren't anticipated. And so the biggest miss is simply due to the fact that the assumptions going forward did not hold true.
Well, I would ask, I guess maybe both you and Dr. Perlin, based on this current history, the $1 billion shortfall, is that the result of a reasonable error that nobody could do anything about, or is that the result of lack of efficiency or whatever the case might be? But your request for next year, 06, and the bill is already over at the Senate, is it already off by at least that $1 billion?
Sir, thank you for your summation of that.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's a good summation, but all right, go ahead.
The statement you make is that has the use of resources in 2005 affected the budget assumptions going into 2006? And I think it's absolutely fair to say that it has. We had intended to carry over, obviously, more than we will be able to.
But you talked about the capital in responding to Mr. Michaud. You talked about using capital dollars. So those capital dollars, assuming that they're needed dollars, will now have to be made up for in 06. But that's already past us now, unless the Senate can do something with it. So it might even carry over to 07. So I guess what I'm saying is, are we robbing Peter to pay Paul?
The capital dollars, the investments in infrastructure, will eventually have to be made.
Yeah, so they're eventually going to have to be made up somewhere along the line. Yeah.
Right. But the resources are there to assure the care for veterans in 2005. It does impact our 06.
Yeah. I appreciate the fact that the resources are there for 05, because we've been very concerned about that. And hopefully, based on the question here, we're satisfied that that's the case. But now we've got 06 ahead of us, and that's kind of being compounded by virtue of the fact that some of the resources used in 05 for this purpose or intended to be used for another purpose. I'm just going to ask one quick question. It's about the fastest 5 minutes I think I've ever experienced. But, Ms. Patterson, are you getting complete cooperation from the VA in terms of your advice to them and whatnot?
Yes.
You are?
Yes. They provide any data that I request. They provide experts when I need additional.
Are they using, though, the data that you recommend to them, the actuarial data that you recommend to them?
I can't attest to that.
You can't attest to that.
I provide it, and that's as far as I go.
Try calling somebody.
All right. I get in the interest of time.
Mr. Udall. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my first question is for Mr. Perlin and Mr. Koukoulas. how is the VA making sure that returning soldiers that are being put into these models, and how are you ensuring that they are accurately projected and that they provide the needed resources for these new veterans as they come into the VA healthcare system?
Thank you, Mr. Udall, for that question. The
vote right now.
Secretary has made an absolute commitment that new combat veterans receive priority in accessing care in our system. And so let me assure you, through our seamless transition, the good partnership with the Department of Defense, we have more awareness than ever in terms of meeting the clinical needs of new veterans. They send us rosters to help us identify these new veterans. And in fact, when a veteran needs care, military treatment facility to VA, we actually have VA social workers, and they have uniformed personnel reciprocally placed in military treatment facilities and VA hospitals. So the clinical is very smooth. To the point of your question, 2.5 to 3.5 years ago, the budgeting couldn't anticipate these current numbers. With the numbers that we are now commenting on, these veterans who've come to us with their eligibility following combat service, that's being incorporated into the model going forward.
I'm sorry. So, let me just follow up on that. So what you're saying is 2.5 to 3 years ago, because this was a new situation, having as many troops in combat as we had, it was a very unpredictable situation, how many injuries you would get, the kinds of things that you would see. And now, having a more stable kind of situation, you're able to predict.
Yes.
Is that a fair characterization of what you're saying?
In fact, previously we'd used separation data, and we got that periodically in 2001 because the trends of separation were fairly constant. With the increased op tempo and veterans who have unique eligibility by virtue of combat service, they have 2 years of eligibility, and we welcome those veterans. That couldn't have been anticipated 2.5 to 3.5 years ago. It's to the best we can incorporate it, being incorporated now, but 2005 predicts for 2008, 2004 for 2007.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
The only thing I could add to Dr. Perlin's comments would be that it really gets into that first snapshot you take in the beginning of your fiscal year with regard to your population. Rather than you using a static snapshot of where everybody is, you really need to take that actuarial look that estimates where people are going to be based on deployments, expected major movements in retirement, et cetera, to get the best idea of where everybody's going to be so that when you do put that forecast in place with that population, you can appropriate the money in the right places for those people. That has not bothered us in the DOD as much, and I think Dr. Perlin's comment, the partnership between the VA and DOD works well in that part in sharing the information. For the DOD specifically, where our forecast is challenged is in the whole TRICARE for Life. The discussions a little bit earlier about as retirements come in and where do people get their health care, our ability to forecast the take rate for these people who are eligible for TRICARE for Life and those who decide to keep their own private insurance has been the tougher part. So the actual care for the active duty and then going to the VA, we feel we have a pretty good handle on. It's that take rate for that retiree group that we, you know, the under 65 retired or over 65 retired is where we find our biggest challenge.
I'm shifting direction a little bit here. One of the big problems that I see is Congress passing laws and requiring that health care be given to veterans, and then we also give discretion to the department to create priorities and categories and all of that. And clearly we have this big debate about Category 7 and 8 and the different the different kind of care that the different veterans get. And I think many of us on this committee would like to see the Congress fully fund health care for all veterans. And there have been bills to that effect. When you do your modeling, I mean, could you tell us what it would cost in terms of dollars to not have these kinds of categories and various priority and just say we're going to make sure that all veterans have the kind of health care they need? What kind of numbers would we be looking at? I mean, that's what the next panel tries to do, I think, when they look at an independent budget. They're looking at at they're not looking at the constraints that the various departments have. They're looking at what kind of dollars are you going to put into the system to make sure that every veteran gets health care, adequate health care in a timely way, and that's quality health care.
Kirksman, that's really the point of the model, the ability to predict the utilization, be it by category or disease condition, exactly what resources are needed to provide safe, timely, effective, efficient, compassionate care for the veteran. I defer to the actuary for any elaboration, because we do believe it's a useful tool, albeit this year we pushed the performance envelope in terms of the lag time and missed the mark by a bit.
Yes, the model itself has the capabilities of estimating the impact of many policy decisions, and one, if you're going to open up the system even more, and we can estimate the impact of that in the actual dollars associated with opening your doors even wider and maybe enticing more people, more veterans to enroll and seek health care. It's absolutely in the realm of an eligible projection.
I see my time's out, and I thank you. Appreciate very much, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you. There's a vote on the rule. I intend to stay here and keep this going. Mr. Brown?
Mr. Chairman, just one question. I noticed in our discussion that Department of Defense really acknowledged that they were having a shortfall in their health care, and they asked for some money in the supplemental. And I was, my question, I guess, is Dr. Perlin, if did y'all not sense that, or did y'all not have the opportunity to do the same?
Thank you, Congressman Brown, for that question. You know, when we look at the utilization numbers, the number of veterans requiring care every month, and through February, things were looking pretty on target. Actually, in the months in April, began to ramp up and see more increase against utilization. As mentioned earlier, thanks to the robust support in the past years going into this year, and because of being fairly much on target, we felt that and still do believe that we have the resources for this year, for 2005. It's been discussed. It does predict some challenges in 2006.
Mr. Chairman, if I might follow up on that, I noticed the is there some kind of a trend that maybe the enlisted personnel is not re-upping as regular? Are we getting more folks that are leaving the service earlier that might be shifting some of the more costs to the VA that might, if they stayed in service, their health care would be funded by DOD? Is there any trend in that direction?
I can't speak to that trend. I will take that for the record. I can't speak of any trend offhand that I've seen. Again, to reiterate, the trend we've seen is in the enlisted population, the actuarial analysis and the cost estimates tend to be rather consistent with what we modeled. It's that retired under 65 and over 65 and their take rates that end up surprising us on any given forecasting period.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one follow-up question. Then, is there any in the trend model, is the projected amount of money coming from third-party pay, is that on target, or is there a shortfall in that projection?
I guess the best way to answer it, it's never where you want it to be. We have some targets. We continue our efforts, but there's a lot more that we can do, and we're always looking for good ideas, whether it's in-house, whether it's working with contractors. I know the Navy, for example, does both in-house and contracts out for third-party collections. The Air Force is 100% contracted out, while the Army does its own in-house. So everybody's looking for best practices and trying to up it and increase our third-party collections.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you all, too, for coming and being part of this discussion and you know, helping us work through a tough situation. Thank you very much.
I don't know how well prepared, Dr. Perlin, you are to put some dollars on this, but I'm trying to understand this a little bit better. So in the as we go into the 05 budget, that was really sort of laid out in 03.
05, I believe, really based on 02 data.
Based on 02 data for 05.
That's right.
And at in 02 data, I'm trying to figure out what's the variance to come up with this present-day challenge that you have to face, that you have to move funds around. So outside of OIF, OEF, dental, CAT 7s and 8s utilization, what else was there?
Let me
pharmaceutical? Or is that part of the utilization costs? I mean, help me out. I'm trying to.
We've tried to anticipate the pharmaceutical growth. We have made efficiencies in pharmaceutical utilization, but we continue to push for those efficiencies, and they do get harder. Once you've gone from two equally effective drugs to one that's equally effective but less expensive, there's no more there. So we're pushing in that regard.
How about
Mr. Kukulis mentioned the Tamiflu, unanticipated. We have been worried about
Tamiflu.
I'm sorry. This Mr. Kukulis from Department of Defense gave an example of a completely unanticipated contingency. And as you know, people have concerns about the avian flu being a world pandemic. And with our population, particularly with a lot of older and chronically ill veterans, we had to expend, as an example, $25 million to make sure that we had adequate stores of this treatment for that avian influenza.
Well, tsunami wasn't in yours either, all right? That was a large cost. With regard to medical inflation, the medical inflation data that was input from 02 based on what then happened in 05, how were we? Off? Not off?
I'd ask Ms. Reed to comment.
Is there any contributing
on
factor on that number?
Do you want to ask Art to comment on that relative to the model?
Yes, the model certainly looks at the healthcare industry trends, and Milliman has a very robust price trending that they use. Obviously, it's looking at historical, but it does go out into the future too. So even if 02 was the time frame in which the data that the budget was looking at, they would come forward to VA. They would bring in their price trend experts, and we would sit around and talk and see which of those trends and utilizations rate seems to be related to VA. And then we would resolve and agree to the price trending for the future. And that is incorporated in the model every year, and we update that annually.
Is this a work product that belongs to your company that others then utilize, or you rely on this data input from someone else?
Well, we have certain experts within the firm who every year update some of our tools that are strictly for measuring healthcare cost trends. And they're involved in these meetings, and they fully understand the healthcare trends and what moves them in different directions and why and when. And those discussions are held with many folks at VHA to determine which ones are applicable to the VA healthcare systems and which ones are not. For instance, typical provider discounts aren't typically applicable in the VHA. And so we know to remove the impacts of those. And so the actual research that goes into these products are used by private sector and other government entities, but we do modify it for VHA.
All right, well, let's get into your last statement on the modification for VHA. Over the last 5 years, would you be able to tell me what numbers that you utilize in the private sector? They range from 9 to 16%. Is that about right?
I would not be able to give you a number for that, no.
Am I close when I say between 9 and 16%?
It depends. I mean, when you're looking at a full comprehensive healthcare package, trends can be deceiving because each benefit package can generate a different trend. Okay. So I apologize for not
That's
being
fine.
Able to answer,
I mean, you
but
could say
they are big.
Exclusive of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
All right. Then let me ask you this. Why do you pick a number? Let's say that you call it the healthcare cost index. Isn't that what you registered?
That's what
trademark?
That's what our product is, yes.
Okay. So let's say, for example, hypothetical, it's 8% for next year. You come up with a different number with regard to what you put into the model for VHA.
Right, and so I
and
guess
let me ask this question.
Okay.
Why?
Why?
Why do we use a different number for VHA?
Okay, well, for one thing, we don't use a single number. We use many different trend rates for different things. We have a utilization trend rate. We have an inflationary trend rate. We have an intensity trend rate. And they all vary by type of service. So when you say 8%, that could be 8% inflation and intensity trends for pharmacy. And then we look at that and say, well, the pharmacy trends in the private sector are going up by X amount. But in VA, which you have much more price control because VA is more is a huge purchaser of prescription drugs. So that they have a lot of buying power, and so that's dampened. And we want to reflect that. We don't want that to skyrocket like
okay.
the private sector.
It's a very good explanation.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with regard to the calculation of that number that's utilized within the model?
Yes, I am, sir.
All right. For a model that, Dr. Perlin?
We're just, Mr. Chairman, forgive the follow-up. We're having some internal discussion and think we can flesh out the question that you asked a little bit better. You asked what other sorts of things can vary. And let me just give you some examples. In terms of building off of what we've been discussing, the increased utilization by veterans in this current year, that has the effect not only of producing healthcare costs for the care of those individuals, but carrying additional staff on board, and that is an additional and unanticipated expense. There are other items that are outside of the actuarial model. The actuarial model accounts for 87% of the clinical budget, and some of those areas are also inflating. And one is a program, CHAMP VA, which, of course, is the program for 100% service-connected veterans, families, dependents, or the families and dependents of deceased 100% service-connected veterans. Those expenditures increase as well. In that as well to date, not in the actuarial model, is the long-term care. And we've had some robust discussion about long-term care in this with this committee previously, but as everyone's aware, that's a very important area, an area where we're trying to actually extend our dollars by serving veterans in the community to an even greater extent. And then there are some assumptions that we think are overly ambitious. And I know that there have been reports about what possibilities there might be in contracted care, as an example, and our new chief business officer is working to consolidate in those areas. But some of those are extremely ambitious. And in aggregate, that really is what generates the challenges that we're discussing.
You know, I don't want to, I guess what I'm going to try to do here is I'm going to take all your testimony, I'm going to take the statements, I'm going to be a very good student, and get the input also from my colleagues and the staff with regard to the model itself. Looking at, yes, how Congress also does its budgeting processes, recognizing that, understandably, that DOD wants to go to a more predictable model. So I'm going to be sensitive to why you've made these judgments and decisions. At the same time, I'm going to be saying, are there lessons learned that can be applicable here? And hopefully you two can have those discussions. Okay? Can that happen?
Yes, sir.
So we can have some better predictability, because I really am tortured here inside that we have passed recently an 06 budget that came to us from the administration, even though we plussed up $1 billion, I now don't know what the right number's supposed to be for 06. So we've got some carry-on discussions to be made with regard to your these trends, okay? And you mentioned about these risk adjustments, okay? So somewhere in here that even though you are pressing the bounds or going to the horizon, okay, on these projections, there really is this, we call it the nebulous, that risk adjustment area. It's that gut check at the end of what may or the possibilities or the potentials, and we missed. You missed, right? And there are these things that just weren't calculated. And we Congress has to be responsive. And that's where we want to work with you with regard to these 06. We'll be watchful and good listeners with regard to workaround, with regard to its impact in the system, and maintaining, as I just heard you say in your testimony, to maintain the quality of care. Obviously, there will be an interest with regard to the access also, recognizing that Congress set up a prioritization with regard to that access of care. And I noted from your testimony, the first words out of your mouth were, we're taking care of those men and women coming back. I want to thank all of you for coming. This is very constructive, what you've done here today. You've been very helpful, and we're going to continue with regard to the actual science of this. It's hard. It's difficult. You have an expertise. I'm appreciative. We're going to need that. Please don't become so defensive of the model. Allow us to figure out how we use this model in the private sector and how it can best forecast for us with regard to our budgets and predictability, recognizing now today that we are pressing the limits of your model. Correct?
Correct.
All right. Of any model? Well, especially the one we care about is the veterans piece, and equally the DOD piece. I want to thank you. The second panel, let me do it by way of an introduction, and then I have to exit, and hopefully I can make it back. If any of you can stay, that's wonderful. If you can't, if you could have some of your staff stay, it'd be wonderful. The second panel is Mr. Steve Robertson. He serves as director of the National Legislative Commission of the American Legion. Don't leave yet. Hold on. He is the Legislative Commission. Steve Robertson serves as the director of the National Legislative Commission of the American Legion. Prior to joining the American Legion, Mr. Robertson served as Disabled Veterans Program Specialist for the Job Service, North Dakota, and as a military policeman in D.C. Army National Guard. He is also a veteran of the Gulf War. Testifying also is Mr. Doug Vollmer, is the Associate Executive Director of Government Relations for PVA. Mr. Vollmer is involved in a variety of issues concerning PVA's members, such as the veterans and disability rights for 26 years for the PVA. We also have, I apologize, Tim Fieser. I apologize. He is principal with Reedon and Anders, with a background in actuarial consulting services in the management of healthcare arena for 18 years. He's previously worked extensively with forecasting healthcare demand and has provided assistance to hospitals regarding service demand planning. So I want all of you to know that what we've attempted to do here today is not only examine what we do in the private sector, what you've done within DOD, the transitions you're doing to DOD to a new model, and with what your model has been done, even though it has pressed the horizons, you've been very fortunate for the last 4 or 5 years. This year, challenges and workaround solutions for which we'll be very attentive and provide our oversight to. Please help us with in a bipartisan fashion as we move forward into the 06. We will then receive our input from the veteran service organizations. We're all advocates. That's what I like about this. whether those of us on this committee, whether it's those in the VA, whether it's in DOD, whether it's the VSOs. No one has the cornerstone here in the advocacy of our veterans. Thank you very much. Panel one is now excused. Panel two is recognized. Come forward.
We appreciate you all coming. Our second panel consists of Mr. Steve Robertson, who serves as director of the National Legislative Commission of the American Legion. Prior to joining the American Legion, Mr. Robertson served as a disabled veterans program specialist for Job Service, North Dakota, and as a military policeman in the D.C. Army National Guard. He also served in the U.S. Air Force for 12 years. My father was retired Air Force, so. Mr. Douglas Vollmer is the Associate Executive Director of Government Relations for Paralyzed Veterans of America. Mr. Vollmer has been involved in a variety of issues concerning PVA's members, such as veterans and disability rights, for 26 years at PVA. Mr. Tim Fieser is a principal with Reedon and Anders Limited with a background of actuarial consulting services in the managed health care arena for 18 years. He has previously worked extensively with forecasting health care demand and has provided assistance to hospitals regarding service demand planning. Your prepared statements will be entered into the record. And I now recognize Mr. Steve Robertson.
And I do agree that this is a very important hearing. The American Legion continues to advocate for adequate funding levels to ensure America's veterans receive the health care and benefits they have earned through their honorable military service. The basic difference between the American Legion's VA budget recommendation and that of the President's budget request and the Congress budget is that the American Legion's budget is demand-driven, whereas yours are often budget-driven. In fact, the American Legion recommendations are probably more consistent with what the VA sends to OMB and before the initial passback. Mr. Chairman, all of the budgeting models and methodologies available, Congress's budget process is probably the least effective to provide proper funding for the VA. The VA's Office of Assistant Secretary for Management and the folks that were here earlier are well-staffed and are very competent professionals. However, the Congress and the American taxpayers are not getting their money's worth because the best product, the true budgetary needs of the VA, is submitted to OMB. Clearly, if Congress and the American people were allowed to see the initial product rather than the watered-down version, everyone involved in the budget process could work towards a solid product, supported by the President, supported by Congress, and supported by the American people. Nobody wants to shortchange America's veterans and their families. Nobody. The American Legion does not advocate simply throwing money at a problem without accountability. However, we do believe that VA needs the fiscal resources to operate the very best system possible. Maintaining a strong national defense is a top national priority, while VA is the end product of winning wars and maintaining peace. Clearly, there are tremendous differences between the budgeting models and methodologies between VA and DOD medical care. In the VA, health care delivery is not all veterans are equal, have equal access to the quality care that they want to receive, even if they're willing to pay for it. Currently, the priority group 8, the most likely to have resources and third-party insurance coverage, are denied enrollment regardless of their honorable military service in wartime, in combat or peacetime. Within the Department of Defense, all eligible beneficiaries are welcomed to enroll and have equal access to timely health care within their assigned regions. The American Legion's budget methodology basically relies on internal and external factors. Some of the internal factors is the System Worth Saving, a publication that we've put out each year. The CARES Task Force, another internal organization, program of our organization, a formal network of service officers that actually work in and around VA medical facilities, a network of homeless veterans program advocates and providers, information we receive from other advocacy groups, and, of course, informed government sources. External factors include such things as the Presidential Task Force that we just completed that was to look into ways to improve health care delivery for our nation's veterans. The President's budget request is very, very helpful. The budget resolution kind of gives us a look ahead of where you're planning on going, and, of course, the annual VA budget. The American Legion's health care modeling, we were deeply concerned in the 80s with the fact that there were few veterans having access to the system. Primarily, service-connected disabled veterans, economically indigent, and CHAMPVA eligibles were the ones that had access, but even that access was very, very complicated. Military beneficiaries were also having trouble with CHAMPUS, having trouble with timely access and soaring costs. The American Legion believed there was a better way to meet the health care needs of the American veterans and their families. After much deliberation, the American Legion offered to Congress a new health care model that was extremely visionary for the VA in the health care delivery in the 21st century, and we called it the GI Bill of Health. Some of the key factors of that talked about mandatory versus discretionary funding, Medicare reimbursements for the VA, third-party reimbursements not being counted as an offset to the discretionary account, the enrollment process, how it should be done, the defined benefit packages so that there was no doubt as to what kind of health care you were entitled to, timely access standards, availability of services, and also the VERA formula, how the money was actually distributed within a vision. Mr. Chairman, VA, Congress, and the American Legion all share the same goal, as the Chairman said. That's meeting the needs of America's veterans. And working together, we can achieve that goal. It's all about national priorities. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson. Mr. Vollmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank the members of the committee on behalf of Paralyzed Veterans of America. We appreciate this opportunity to present our views and experiences on the methodology used in formulating the annual recommendations contained in the independent budget. In general, I will keep my remarks centered on the major budget accounts supporting the provision of VA medical care. The first independent budget was published 19 years ago. Former VA Chief Medical Director and Surgeon General of the Navy, retired Vice Admiral Donald Custis, suggested that the four veteran service organizations, AMVETS, Disabled American Veterans, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and Veterans of Foreign Wars, form a unique partnership to develop and publish yearly VA budget views and estimates. The resulting independent budget should be used, he strongly felt, to demonstrate the actual financial needs of VA health care and other programs in the face of administration budget requests and congressional appropriations that were far too often influenced more by political considerations and the changing pressures of federal budget policy than by objective medical budget modeling. The independent budget presents a full budget model. It is the same model that VA uses at the beginning of its annual budget process. The VA and the administration generally abandoned this process at that point. At this time, the VA budget then leaves the arena of pure budget modeling and enters the long road through OMB and the congressional budget and appropriations process as being shaped by, quote, what the freight will bear in the competition for funding with all other domestic discretionary programs. The IB does not take this course. It simply takes the amount of the current year appropriations and adds to each account assumptions regarding inflation and salary increases to arrive at a current services estimate for the upcoming year. The current services baseline is a commonly understood concept in Congress. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office is mandated by law to treat discretionary spending what is essentially a current services model. A current services estimate provides a baseline that presents a theoretical value of what it would cost to provide the same level of services in the following year as was provided in the current year. From that point, the independent budget presents an estimate as to the cost of individual recommendations found within the document, such as increased FTE, increased patient loads, and changes to current policies. I'm attaching a white paper prepared and submitted to the committee at the request of the chairman earlier this year, and I request that it be placed in the record. This paper provides additional technical detail as to how we assess the impact of annual wage and salary increases, as well as formulas for estimating the effect of general inflation and other specialized indices on the VA budget accounts. In closing, PVA, on behalf of the other independent veteran service organizations, believes we can present and defend the full funding methodology that provides our annual recommendations. By contrast, any similar medical model that VA itself might put forward in initial recommendations for the following fiscal year becomes muddied in the actual ensuing budget and appropriations processes that follow. Overall budget increase requests are artificially skewed, claiming so-called increases that are only unrealistic management efficiencies. Budgets are inflated by equally unachievable third-party collections. In terms of real requests for real additional appropriations, most administrations submit budgets on the cheap. They use no real medical model and leave it to the Congress to try to make the fix. The end result has no reality to the actual need, cost, and demand of health care services. And from year to year, with the uncertainty of the budget and appropriations process, VA managers and the veterans they serve have little assurance that full support for their programs will be there when they need that support. The independent budget VSOs can only come to the realization that the current budget system is flawed, unscientific, and does not meet the true needs of the veteran population. For this reason, we endorse a new approach that will apply a realistic medical model to a guaranteed funding base that will support veterans' health care services to the extent veterans need them when veterans need them. Such a system is good public policy and good medicine. This concludes my testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Fazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the Committee on Veterans Affairs. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you on the private sector approach to health care expense forecasting. I'm Tim Fazer, a principal with Redden & Anders. We're a national actuarial, clinical, and management consulting firm that specializes in financial and business support decisions for the healthcare industry. In discussing our approach to the healthcare expense forecasting process, I'd like to summarize how historical healthcare claims experience is used, how healthcare expense trend assumptions are developed, and their application to historical experience to produce a forecasted healthcare expense budget. I'll conclude with comments regarding emerging practices seen as improvements to the healthcare expense forecasting process. First, I'll address the use of historical experience. We'd like to collect as much historical experience as we possibly can for an existing block of business, as referred to in the industry. That's an insured membership base for a health plan. We'd like to go back at least a minimum of 2 years, more if the data has been collected. We then need to complete that information because we like to use the most recent year possible of that historical claims experience in our projections forward. That involves performing a lag analysis, which is used to complete that recent year's worth of experience, since often at the time of performing your projections, the total payments have not entirely been made for all services delivered in that last calendar year of experience to be projected off of. That's an important point in that if you do not complete that experience, your base period will be understated, therefore your future forecast would be understated, assuming your trends were correct. After performing the lag analysis and completing your experience, you want to summarize that experience into meaningful expense categories for which to perform your projections. Typically in the industry, we see groupings such as hospital inpatient care, inpatient setting defined by type of stay, be that a medical stay or a surgical stay, deliveries and the like. Outpatient categorizations in the facility side include emergency room services, elective surgeries in the outpatient setting, diagnostic tests, and other services. On the physician side, we like to group things based on definition of service, which uses the CPT code definitions of classification. Meaningful categorizations that are sensitive to how benefits change over time helps in the modeling process. For example, categorizing physician services by routine office visits, elective surgeries, allergy, immunizations, and the like, which are high-volume services delivered to the patient population. And then finally, prescription drugs are also summarized separately by brand name prescriptions and separately for generic prescriptions. Finally, you'll want to track your historical experience and segment it into what's referred to as allowed claims versus net paid claims, the difference being what the member pays as far as their out-of-pocket costs, whether that's co-payments, deductibles, and co-insurance. That's features of the benefit designs offered. Next, I'll address trend assumptions. In developing trend assumptions, we want to develop them specific to the medical expense categories that we just discussed. We also want to break out trend component into two major components, utilization and unit price, often referred to as medical cost inflation. An example to illustrate how the private sector drills down into analyzing the unit cost component of trend, I'll focus on the inpatient setting. Typically, a large insurer has several contracts with various hospital facilities across the country. Those contracts are renegotiated in a staggered way over time, such that a high-volume hospital could be coming due for renegotiation, and the health plan may expect a spike in their unit price that year for that hospital due to the hospital having not renegotiated their contracts for several years. At the onset of those negotiations, the plan tries to gauge how rapidly those inpatient costs may increase. Could be as much as 20% if the hospital has not changed costs with the health plan for several years. Inflator clauses are built into those agreements that may last 2 to 3 years out at a much lower rate of trend, say 3 to 5%. So this drill down analysis involves getting to an aggregate unit price trend based on how the individual facilities contracts come due over time, which affects the ultimate trend assumption applied for the unit price on hospital side. This analogous approach is used on the outpatient, physician, and prescription drug side as well in developing unit cost. After your trend assumptions are developed, you apply them to your historical experience to arrive at a forecasted budget, whether you're a self-insured employer or a health plan, forecasting your total expenses that underlie your pricing. Finally, in closing, some advanced recent practices that are being used to help improve the forecasting process include more drill-down analysis of the impact of past technologies and new emerging technologies, a look at brand prescriptions going off patent and the impact of lower-cost generic prescriptions and their impacts on trends and increased utilization of lower-cost generics, and then finally, the importance of new disease management vendors that are having a great impact on managing chronic disease cohorts within an insured population base. That concludes my testimony on the private sector's approach to healthcare expense forecasting. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vollmer, a lot has been made about the disparity between the VA budgeting process and then the independent budget. Can you say again can you describe again the basic fundamental differences as to how you arrive at your information versus the VA?
Yes, sir. I believe we start at the same place the VA does, and we use a lot of VA data. In the development, we look at current services, what was appropriated for the given year. We look at what the projected salary or wage increases will be, the rates of inflation, medical inflation, various things like that, and build those up to make a VA budget for the next year that will also reflect the same level of services that are currently being provided. At that time, we look at any additional costs or recommendations that we would then be recommending within the context of the independent budget. The VA does that, I think, at the same time when they initially develop their budget. I think they explained that a bit. But then when they go through the pass-back series and it gets in, moves away from modeling and gets into the realm of political policy, their budget begins to be muddied and is pressured by the requirements for other domestic programs, for administration priorities, for all kinds of things, and it loses the true clean nature, I think, that it had when the first numbers were put together. That's when certain policy decisions might be made to reduce sevens or eights. We predicate the independent budget funding for all veterans that would come into the system and not restricting access to certain categories of veterans. So I think that's where we depart, particularly at the time the pass back and it moves out of VA into the broader political arena.
The VA uses Milliman to validate their process. Do you use an outside source to help with your process to validate it?
In the original development of the independent budget some 19 years ago, we had outside sources that worked with us. We brought some of those sources in-house. We have had consultants over time that tweak or fine-tune the mechanism we need. And, in fact, on some modeling at VA, we work with the Milliman people on developing modeling and cares process and things in the area of spinal cord injury care, for example.
Mr. Robertson, your modeling is a little bit different in the sense that with a demand-based model, I guess, why is that? Can you reiterate again as to why you feel like that's a more accurate?
Well, yes, sir. Ours is validated by patients being turned away from the system, patients being denied timely access, facilities that are in need of a repair, backlogs and inventory for equipment, robbing Peter to pay Paul accounts to keep the system going to where we're not having to shut the doors at the end of the year. That's a pretty good validation process because it deals with the lives of veterans. I mentioned the program that we have, A System Worth Saving. We started this 3 years ago where our national commander is visiting facilities. And matter of fact, our national commander right now is in Denver visiting the VA facilities in that area to compile a report. And a lot of the information we get comes back from VA employees. We send questionnaires out to all of the facilities. We got back 125 out of the 163 we distributed. And this is all done with the help of the VA. In fact, this year we focused strictly on budget issues, and we sent out a second questionnaire that was more narrowed focused on the facilities. So, you know, clearly we can have all kinds of models, and they can work really, really well if they're done the way that they're advertised. But once it gets into this bureaucratic process, and we all understand budgets. My boss sends me a thing telling me to do a budget. I have to put it together. I put down what I want. He tells me this is what you're going to get. Do we run short? Absolutely. Does he know we're going to run short? Absolutely. And we deal with it later on down the road. When you're dealing with the lives of veterans and their family members, we shouldn't be playing that kind of a game. When we're talking about a decision of to give them the best prescriptions possible, or find the cheapest deal that we can get away with, that is not honoring the service of the men and women that are allowed to go to the VA facilities.
You mentioned mandatory funding, you know, as a method of getting, you know, getting out of this to make things better. And certainly that's being discussed here. And, you know, I guess one of the concerns I have is that if you look at the countries that have done that, then it seems to inevitably lead to rationing of care. In other words, you know, you wait a long time, you know, get your hip replacement or your knee replacement or things like that. Can you comment on that?
Yes, sir. There's a couple of things I need to comment that I think need to be cleared up. There was one comment about setting up a system where all veterans would have access to the system. First of all, if you look at every other healthcare system that's out there, whether it be DOD, Medicare, whatever, their enrollment participation of the number of people that are eligible versus the number of people that actually enroll probably runs 85% to 90%. So people that are entitled to those benefits are using those benefits in large numbers. Out of the VA healthcare system, there's 24 million veterans. And right now the system's open to all of them. 7 million have enrolled. So there's a little self-governing in here that needs to be understood. And if you do a mandatory funding formula or the guaranteed full funding formula that the American Legion has talked about with other folks, we're talking about an enrolled patient population that still complies with the laws on the books. In other words, sevens and eights, if they're being treated for non-service-connected conditions, they will reimburse the government. There's still the obligation of them helping to pay for their care, which will help drive down the formula because of how much is actually having to be spent on health care. Secondly, the VA, if you look at the cost per patient, is probably the best deal in the entire health care industry. And I think that was verified during the presidential task force when they would show the cost of care for VA versus Medicare, the average cost for taking care of somebody in Medicare, and versus DOD. I think it's something that needs to be looked at. I think that there's veterans that we say in Title 38 the Secretary shall provide care for, and without question, they should be included in that mandatory funding cycle. All other veterans that come to the system, we have no objections with them paying for their care. The final point is the Medicare reimbursements. I guarantee you there's not a healthcare professional in this country, and I guess I'm including you too, that if you got a Medicare patient and the government told you you couldn't bill them, I don't think you'd think that was a very good idea. And that's what we've done with the VA system. Right now, the VA is probably subsidizing Medicare to the tune of billions of dollars. I would estimate probably around $3 billion because we can't even bill for treatment of non-service-connected medical conditions. And so many of these Medicare-eligible veterans want to come to the VA for so many very good reasons: quality doctors, a database that maintains all the records in one place, a prescription plan that's affordable. I mean, you can just the fact that if you go to a doctor on the outside, you have to find somebody that's accepting new Medicare patients. If he sends you to a specialist, you got to go find a specialist that's accepting new Medicare patients. It's a hassle. So the VA system, because of its reputation with the quality of care, because of its accessibility, is a natural magnet for a lot of these folks. Why can't we take advantage of that? Why can't Medicare reimburse VA for the services that it's rendering? Because that's part of the discretionary budget. Finally, counting the third-party collections as an offset. You've already talked about how bad the collection process is. That's a major part of the problem. When you offset the discretionary account, you're already putting everybody in the hole. When the VERA distribution is made and the goals are given out to every VA medical facility, they're unachievable, and everybody knows it. So the VA directors are already working at a disadvantage. And places where the collections are very good, what's their reward? They get a higher goal the next year. Places that do miserable, what's their reward? They get a higher goal. So there's a lot of problems that need to be fixed. Our funding model, it may not be the most scientific in the world, but it's the most realistic in the world because we base it upon the services that are actually getting to G.I. Joe and Jane.
Thank you. Mr. Mishaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first question goes to Mr. Feaser. What would you do that would be dramatically different from what Milliman is currently doing in their modeling effort, if anything?
Well, first off, it would be difficult to really answer the question accurately without knowing a lot about the VA program at a level of detail that I'd need to know to comment on differences in modeling techniques. But from what I gathered in the conversation this morning, it appears as such that the mechanics seem fairly standard of the industry and the approach taken, looking at historical experience, utilization, unit pricing assumptions, and attempting to complete that experience for lag, and then projecting that out to a future point in time. And I believe the point was also made to the model in that forecast is as accurate as it can be for that first year of the budget you're projecting. The ensuing years after that, the projections would be very soft. More information emerges that was unknown. It gets accounted for in a second go-around at a future forecast. So it's hard for me to specifically point to differences in what we would do versus what's been done. I would speculate that it would be fairly consistent.
My next question is both for Mr. Robertson and Vollmer. You both talked to a lot of your members, and I guess I'm looking at the outcome. And we heard the Assistant Secretary of the VA talk this morning that taking care of the veterans' need. Are you hearing that from your veterans as far as demand for health care? Is it being met?
Steve, if I may.
Go ahead.
I would say that with the veterans returning from Iraq, Afghanistan, are getting into the system, as Dr. Perlin said. The thing that's of concern to us is that there are older veterans that are getting pushed out the back end as they're moving in the front end. They aren't being put on the curb, but their appointments are being delayed, time's being stretched out. I think we'll see more of that as we talk to individual hospital directors and healthcare providers around the country. The shortfall, Dr. Perlin acknowledged, for this year, where they're borrowing from all types of accounts to keep the ship afloat. They realize come October 1st, if not sooner, that when they're dealing with the 06 appropriated level, they're going to be even in more trouble. I mean, you know, we talk about the problems that transpire with just the budget that's sent from down the street up to here for the Congress to wrestle with. Well, that included a 2.3% salary increase, and just this week, the Appropriations Committee passed a 3.1% increase for pay raises for employees. The VA has over 180,000 employees. That money is going to have to be eaten by managers in every station around the country, and the only way that gets eaten is by either having fewer employees or treating fewer veterans. So while, you know, the statement is made that we aren't turning veterans away, by extending either waiting times or services available. I got a call the other day, you know, there's some beds that are closed because they haven't been able to recruit staff, and that may be a manager's way of just extending his budget as far as possible.
As far as how's it coming out at the other end of the pipeline, every veteran that I know, or most of the ones that I know that use the VA system, rave about the quality of care. They're happy about going to the VA, and it's usually their health care provider of choice. The problem is the ones that can't get in are the ones that have delayed access, that they have to go someplace else because of their medical condition needs more timely attention. But it's things like this, the letter that came out of the VA medical facility in Alexandria, where they're acknowledging to the new sevens that may be wanting to roll in the system that they've suspended the suspension of appointments is temporary, depending on the availability of resources, as it has affected all VA medical facilities within the South Central VA healthcare network. This came from the hospital director to folks telling them, you can enroll, but we're not going to be making any appointments for you. So that's a classic example. The most shocking thing that I've heard today, I think, was the comment made about, well, you know, we plussed up the budget by $1 billion. If you look at that account, most of that $1 billion came from taking money away from VA administration and VA facilities. The exact same thing Dr. Perlin was talking about, shifting money from one pot to the other. So, yes, in the press release, we got a $1 billion increase, but in reality, we just rearranged the deck chairs. And I think that is when you take the money away from those accounts, that's where the doctor gets his money to be able to stretch out the budget to the end of the year, and you've already done that for him.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that that letter be submitted for the record.
Yes, without objection.
Yeah. Did you have a follow-up on?
Yes, sir. You know, we sat here and heard about all this modeling and how surprised people were that there's $1 billion-plus shortfall and there may be shortfalls in the future. I'd just like to mention that 2 years ago, then Undersecretary of Health, Dr. Robert Roswell, testifying before this committee, when questioned about mandatory funding, just kind of on the back of an envelope sketched out how he viewed, without a lot of sophisticated modeling, where prices would go. And just in a sentence, I'd quote Dr. Roswell. So a 7% increase associated with enrollment in our highest priority groups, coupled with another 2 to 3% of increased utilization costs, coupled with a conservative estimate of healthcare inflation rates of 4.5 to 5%, yields a 13 or 14% per year increase in the money available to take care of just our core population. I think that, you know, using 13 to 14% every year, we shouldn't be off by $1 billion.
I notice there's a rep still here from Millman. I'm just kind of wondering what was their total dollar figure as far as using their funding model, what was actually needed.
I don't think that information was given out today. I didn't hear it. I would have loved to have heard it.
Mr. Chairman, actually, since we're talking about doing models, and I notice there's someone here still from Millman, I was wondering what the funding model that was presented, what the dollar figure was. And she's here. Is it and I was wondering what that dollar figure is, if she can let me know.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. But would you provide that model to the committee, the dollar? Using your modeling method, you came up with a number, and I'd like to you know what that number is, if you can provide it to the committee.
Why don't you come on up and say that in the mic so well.
The model is produced for VHA by my firm, and given their permission, we will provide whatever it is that you would like to see.
Okay. Is there still someone here from the department?
For the most part, the budget itself, if you read the budget...
Yeah, come on up, and so we can... I know that's a hassle, but...
When the budget is presented, it passes through what you kind of assume is a current services budget, but it includes the assumptions of other policies that change that dollar level. For instance, in the 06 budget, it had the $250 enrollment fee, which reduces the overall dollar estimate for the medical care appropriation. Also had the increase for the increase in the pharmacy copay. So you could almost back into the number that that the actuary model would provide. Also included in that budget are efficiencies at...
Well, if I might interrupt. Yeah, I don't want to back into anything or do any assumptions. I would like, and it gets to the point we're talking about here, modeling and how accurate it is, the independent budget, you know, their modeling. And I'd like to know that what that model recommended that was adequate to take care of the VA. And I think if we get that number of what that model is and what it's going to take to deal with the VA, I think we have a better idea on the assumptions, you know, where the model might be going wrong.
Sure.
Versus what actually was submitted, because what was submitted does not take into account, or will take into account, but it is driven by dollars. It's not driven by an actual model. And if we're going to really figure out whether the model is accurate or not, we got to know what that number is in that model, not what we're dealing with as far as the actual budget. And that's why I like to know, under that modeling, what is that number, so we can figure out whether it was accurate and not, and where will we have to adjust the model to make sure we do get an accurate account.
I think we can provide that for the record.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I do have one concern with that model, because as they were pointed out during the testimony, that there's several different models that are used in conjunction with that. And I think about CARES that we just completed. The long-term care and the mental health portion of CARES was not included as part of the evaluation of CARES, because they said the modeling for that was not what they really thought it should be. So, I mean, we've got a situation now that we've got veterans coming back that are going to be in need of long-term care, and yet we don't even know if we have the modeling to adequately provide for the treatment of the long-term health or mental health problems of those returning veterans.
That's a good point. And I guess if we're going to look at modeling and trying to figure out what the actual dollar amount is going to be needed to take care of our veterans, I think we got to be above board and look at what we currently have and look at the whole system. And as you heard a statement made earlier at the earlier panel, that former Secretary Principe was above board and honest with the committee when he said he needed another $1.2 billion to adequately meet the needs of our veterans. And I appreciate someone who is willing to be honest with the committee. And I think it's important that we have that, not that because we're going to try to point blame or anything. It's just that as elected officials, if we're going to do our job and doing a job that's effective, we got to have accurate information. And I'm not looking at pointing blames. I want to make sure we take care of our veterans. And that's why I think it's important to know, number one, what the VA actually requested versus what we're dealing with, but also, number two, what the modeling was actually given to VA and just so we can compare the three, and I think it's very important for us to have that information.
Well, piggybacking on a comment the gentleman just made, when the initiatives were listed in the budget for increased copayments for prescriptions and the enrollment fee, the modeling said that there'd probably be 1.1 million veterans that would probably disenroll from the system rather than pay those increased rates. So it does have an impact on what's going to be the reaction of the veterans population. Are we really in the business of driving people out of the system? And I think the answer is no.
And I agree.
I want to thank. Do you have any other things? You're free to. Okay, good. Again, I want to thank both panels for being here today. I think this was a very, very good hearing. Certainly, we all share a frustration, I think, of trying to get this right. As Mr. Michel said, you know, we need accurate information to be able to make a determination of where we go with this. I was in Landstuhl, Germany, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and visited with a young guy that literally, we were there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This individual had ran over an explosive device at 4 o'clock the previous morning, Iraqi time. They'd cleaned him up, flown him there, and literally was just coming out of surgery. But he wanted to tell us his story, you know, as to what had happened. And had lost both legs below his waist. And he wanted to know two things. He wanted to know about his wife. He hadn't been married very long. You know, was she going to come? And they reassured him that, yes, you know, she would be reunited with him the next day. They were going to fly him to Walter Reed or Bethesda. So that was taken care of. And then the last thing he said to us, you know, he said, I thought this would happen to, you know, I saw it happen to my friends. I saw it happen to my, you know, my buddies, other guys in my unit. I never thought it would happen to me. And then he said, do you think I'll ever get to walk again? And so we reassured him that that was going to be the case. And so, you know, certainly that's why I'm on this committee, Mr. Michel, the rest of us, you know, we do want to get this right. The other problem is that tomorrow I'm going to a funeral of my favorite uncle, and he's a World War II guy. And he's been very ill for about the last 6 months and died as a result of congestive heart failure, leading to needing, you know, massive, really significant surgery, and just didn't come out of that. But probably his medical bills in the last 6 months have exceeded all of his medical bills, you know, up to now. So there really are things like that, you know, that are going on that make it so difficult. We're running the same problem with health care, not only with the VA system, which is a wonderful system right now, but we're running the same thing with Medicaid, we're running it with Medicare, we're running it with private insurance. Health care now is very difficult to model, you know, by any sector that's doing it, whether it's an insurance company, whether it's the VA or whatever. So it's not something that I don't think there's any blame, but I do think, and I appreciate the chairman, I appreciate the ranking member, you know, calling this meeting and this hearing. This is something that we do have to get our arms around, and I think there is a commitment to do that. Yes, sir.
May I just make one comment in reference to the young man that you visited in the medical facility? You know, we're going to take care of him, and we're going to take care of his family. But we also need to take care of the guys that rescued him off the battlefield, the ones that flew him to the hospital, and the ones that are going to treat him until he's discharged from the military. All of them should have access to the system, not just him.
No, I understand. And like I said, that my uncle, my wife's uncle, he was a World War II guy, and we have taken care of him. Yeah.
Good.
So I agree with you totally. You know, and I can see, you go over, you know, to Iraq, and you see those young guys, and then you see our older vets, you know, and you can just see it in the faces of both. They're just the same folks. I agree with you totally. So, again, that's our commitment, and I think today was a good step in that direction. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Ernie?
I'm sorry. The meeting's adjourned.